So I have the pleasure, it's Nicole Kenny from Virox Technologies, and I'm the moderator for today, and I have the pleasure of getting to introduce Dr. Franco Pagotto. And he's a research scientist at Health Canada in the Bureau of Microbial Hazards. Dr. Pagotto graduated from the University of Ottawa's Medical School in the Department of Biochemistry, Microbiology, and Immunology in 2000. He now oversees the research activities of Listeria and Sakazaki, the Sakazaki Laboratory, and is a co-director of Listeriosis Reference Center for Canada. Dr. Pagotto's work as the co-director for the Listeriosis Reference Center for Canada has led to an increased responsiveness to foodborne listeriosis. He's also set up the listeriosis portion of PulseNet Canada, which allows for Health Canada and the Public Agency of Canada to track foodborne disease outbreaks in real time. Dr. Pagotto was nominated in the category of Most Promising Scientist for his work on Listeriosis monocytogenes, Enterobacter sakazaki, and other foodborne viruses, which has led to a reduction in the incidence of these pathogens in foods and thus reduced health risks in a safer living environment. Dr. Pagotto, I turn it over to you.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be part of this teleclass, and I would like to start by thanking Nicole for that introduction, as well as Dr. Sattar, actually, at CREM for making me aware of this wonderful opportunity to be involved with Weber training, both as a speaker for the first time and actually as a student as I start browsing through some of the past presentations. And finally, I would like to thank Paul Weber for the invitation and for organizing things around a slightly chaotic schedule, and I apologize for not being present last week. So if we go to slide 2, basically I have a little overview of what I'd like to discuss today. Basically I'd like to discuss what the some generalities about listeria and listeriosis, why it's important and why we should be interested in this microorganism, an overview of listeria in the food manufacturing environment. So if I ever use the word in a plant factory, it's I'm not talking about a vegetable or a fruit production, but in an actual food manufacturing industry. Maybe a little bit about the prevalence in the environment and how we can go about thinking in terms of controlling its fate in that environment. What we as a community in general have learned, and maybe end up by discussing some of the major things that came out of our recent Canadian outbreak related to contaminated deli meats. So on page 3 is really a general information slide for but one of the things that's interesting about a teleclass is that we don't know who the audience is. So I thought it might have been interesting to start with an overview of where I fit in the grand scheme of things. So if we start to the left of the slide, we have AAFC, which is the Agriculture and Agri-Food Canada, which is responsible for research and development targeting and focusing on on-farm food safety activities. I am with Health Canada. Health Canada is really responsible for policy and standard settings as well as health risk assessments. We are tied in very closely with the CFIA, which is the Canadian Food Inspection Agency, which actually helps design and deliver the federal food inspection programs, and they monitor industry compliance with acts and regulations. And to the far right of the slide is PHAC, or the Public Health Agency of Canada, which looks more at the human side of things in terms of public health surveillance. They will also lead foodborne illness outbreak investigations when, in Canada, an outbreak spans more than one province. So that gives us a kind of an idea of what, at the federal level, some of the responsibilities are, and somewhere in the middle there of Health Canada, I'm kind of fortunate that I am able to work with colleagues on throughout the continuum. To help make, the proverbial farm-to-fork continuum a much safer place for everybody. So if we move to slide 4, I guess one of the things that we want to, what I try to tell people is, why listeriosis remains such an issue and why is it important outside of the fact that we have the rare outbreaks. I've listed here three, I think, key things that are that help explain that. One is that it's almost ubiquitous in the environment, and it's very hardy. So anywhere that you can think of sampling for, there's a very good chance that you will find it. Listeria is a very cunning organism that is able to survive very well. The middle point is that the organism is psychrotrophic, or that it loves the cold and can actually grow at refrigeration temperatures, even though sometimes the growth rate is not as high. And I think that is a key factor when we have to think about Listeria and controlling it, because temperature is, and temperature control is perhaps the most important commodity in the control of this organism. The last bullet, I guess, on slide four is that while it's rare, Listeria really packs a punch, with a case fatality rate being one of the highest of all infectious agents that can approach 30%. So it's not unlikely that, you know, if 100 people get sick, up to 30% can succumb to a serious infection, and oftentimes it can be fatal. So these three things highlight why I think Listeria continues to remain an issue and the challenges that it poses. If we move to slide five, there's a little background on listeriosis. So the first part really is kind of fortunate, I guess, for the human population that the disease listeriosis is rare. But when it does hit, it can be very, very serious, and we'll see why in a little while. In Canada, we discuss listeriosis in terms of cases per million, which makes, again, listeriosis a rare disease, and of course, the higher the number, the better in terms of cases per, you know, billion would be better, but right now we're at cases per million. In overall, we see about 2.2 hospitalizations per million population, and again, the case fatality rate is quite high, and we'll see why in the next couple of slides. And it's also listed in the second bullet on slide five, the high-risk populations for developing listeriosis. Include the major ones are pregnant women, their unborn fetuses and or neonates, elderly persons, and anybody who has some sort of immunocompromised situation, whether it is organ transplant or other type of immunological deficiency. And probably not surprisingly, elderly people and pregnant women as well, the immune system is not functioning at 100%, and therefore we become more susceptible to infection. There have been many foods that are related with listeriosis, and we'll see those in a couple of slides. On page six, or slide six, I have I was able to pull together some information that describes the age distribution and the rates of infection in Canada. From the years 1995 to 2003, just to give you a little bit of an idea or of a flavor of what we see here in Canada. So on the left side of the graph, we would have cases per individual. On the right side, we have cases per individual per million population. As I said, it was about 2.2 cases per million population per year. And I think from the shape of the graph, you can see that we kind of highlight what we said in the previous slide, that the very young, where the immune system is not fully developed or has not begun to develop, and the more elderly, certainly greater than 60 years old, where the immune system starts to wane, there we see people at the highest risk for developing invasive listeriosis. If we go to the next slide, which is slide number seven, we get an idea here of the types of foods that have been implicated. When people think about listeriosis, we always think about deli meats, soft cheese, and sometimes smoked fish as being the major vehicles for contributing to listeriosis outbreaks or even sporadic cases. The slide on page seven shows us the foods that have been responsible for causing outbreaks in Canada. So on the top one in 1981 was coleslaw that was the vehicle, but it actually was contaminated with manure from a sheep that was sick. And this outbreak in 1981 actually put Listeria on the map worldwide in terms of it being a foodborne pathogen and a foodborne issue. You can see some of the other food commodities that have caused the outbreaks in Canada, and the numbers, the 4B, the 12B, 12A, those are the serotypes that are commonly seen with these outbreaks. In the listeriosis world, I guess, a lot of the outbreaks are usually caused by the serotypes 12A, 12B, or 4B, with the 4B considered to be the more virulent or more dangerous of the strains. And as you can see here, Canada seems to have its own flavor, with serotypes 12A seeming to predominate for whatever reason. And the last one, the deli meat outbreak of 2008, we will get to near the end of this presentation. On slide number 8, what we see is the actual economic impact of listeriosis. And one thing that we try to remember is, here especially the Government of Canada, the primary focus is the healthy aspects of Canadians. But at the same time, we also work with industry, because industry doesn't want, obviously, to be held accountable or responsible for making people sick. And so this slide I usually use in a teaching setting to give an idea that it can be devastating as well for a manufacturing facility when they get implicated with massive recalls, or when their product goes out for consumption and that product happens to be contaminated. And as you can see here, we're talking about millions of pounds of commodity having to be recalled. And oftentimes it could be because one or two samples tested positive during routine surveillance, or in this case here, it's usually because there's an association that's made with some sick individuals. And the information for the maple leaf outbreak of 2008, this is some of the information I was able to find. So it was quite a large amount of food that had to be withdrawn. And as you might imagine, it also challenges the industry in terms of disposal. And, you know, like, how do you really effectively get rid of 35 million pounds of a ready-to-eat deli meat or a ready-to-eat food commodity? So there are challenges there that impact everyone as well. On slide number 9, gives you an idea of the surveillance history that we have in Canada. From 1990 to 1999, listeriosis, all types, so it was invasive and non-invasive, was a nationally notifiable disease in Canada. In 2000, unfortunately, listeriosis was removed from this notifiable disease reporting system. When I joined in 2000, we began an initiative to generate a reference service. So in 2001, we officially launched the Listeriosis Reference Service for Canada, which is co-directed by myself and colleagues at the National Microbiology Lab in Winnipeg. So listeriosis remained reportable in all provinces and territories, except in the province of Quebec, where it was added in 2004. In 2006, invasive listeriosis was added to the National Notifiable Disease. It was officially reinstated as a nationally notifiable disease in 2009, and recently, at the beginning of 2010, it was added to the NESP, or National Enteric Surveillance Program Organism List. So we, one of the, I suppose, not positive, but one of the aspects from an outbreak is that it raises interest, and now we've convinced people that, you know, it's worthwhile to follow listeriosis, even though it's a rare illness and not many people maybe get sick from sporadic cases throughout the year. On slide number 10, I try to list why, or some of the challenges when we think about listeriosis in terms of surveillance. As I mentioned, listeria is a rare disease, and so surveillance aspects have some challenges that need to be addressed. The majority of the cases that we see or tend to see are sporadic. And these are further complicated when the geography is dispersed. So there could be two people or two or three cases of listeriosis, but when the individuals are separated geographically, sometimes it's difficult to make a common link between them. The true rate of unreported illness due to non-invasive strains is also something that's difficult and challenging to do. Listeriosis does come in two forms, invasive and non-invasive. The non-invasive tends to mimic some of the gastroenteritis symptoms that are seen with infections from E. coli, Salmonella, etc. And so sometimes it can be a challenge to diagnose non-invasive listeriosis from some of the other enteric pathogens that cause gastrointestinal issues. Another thing has to do with the long incubation period of listeriosis, so that can be up to 70 days, and this poses a huge problem. On average, it can be up to 2 to 3 weeks where we see symptoms to start manifesting themselves. So trace back, that is to say, trying to locate or pinpoint what people have eaten and making a proper source attribution is often difficult or impossible to do. Myself, I have a hard time remembering what I ate this morning, let alone last night. So if you ask me what I ate 3 weeks ago or a month or 2 months ago, it can be very challenging. Again, listeriosis affects high-risk populations. The elderly may already be predisposed because of their waning immune system. Elderly, sometimes we have issues with trying to do a proper investigation in terms of accurately capturing what was eaten, the behaviors, where they might have shopped, etc. And the consumption pattern in higher risk groups is not always well known and sometimes can be hard to characterize. On slide 11, I just show here two pictures from automobile buses that were captured in Australia. There was a campaign then in the mid to late 90s, I guess, to bring listeriosis to the forefront. And what hit me when I found this is that the line that actually says listeriosis is easy to avoid, and, you know, ask your doctor, and basically that is it. They will tell you how to avoid listeriosis. Now, of course, I hope there aren't a ton of physicians here that will get upset with what I'm about to say, but I know I've got two daughters. One is 5 and the other one is 8, and when my wife was pregnant with the 8-year-old, the hospital was not that aware of what listeria was. And I think that it's good to bring listeria to the forefront, but I think we have to be careful in saying that it is very easy to avoid, and asking your doctor may not always be the best way, because one of the things is with listeriosis being rare in terms of bacterial infections, a lot of physicians may not actually have seen many cases of listeriosis and may not be able to diagnose or realize that a patient is suffering from listeriosis. On slide 12, further highlights why listeria remains an issue. Exposure to listeria, for the most part, is through contaminated food. So maybe over 90% of how we become in contact with listeria would be through a food that is contaminated somehow. As the diagram shows, listeria is able to survive the gastrointestinal tract by association with food particles. You know, if individuals are taking antacids, there's a pH change, and that also helps listeria to survive the stomach acidity. And if listeria remains in the gastrointestinal tract, usually what we tend to see is a febrile gastroenteritis. There is some shedding that may occur, and it's usually self-limiting or it resolves on its own. And those are the symptoms that tend to mimic or be similar to the enteric infections from other enteric pathogens. Listeria is quite cunning in that it can escape the gastrointestinal tract and eventually enter the bloodstream and make its way into the liver, where it likes to call itself home. Once in the liver, usually the macrophages and other cells of the immune system can become recruited to effectively eliminate, but there are chances that have been estimated maybe at 1 in 10 that Listeria is able to escape the liver and then become bloodborne. And if it does so, some of the symptoms would be related to septicemia. And what can make the situation worse is that Listeria is able to cross the three protective barriers that the human body affords. So one obviously being the gastrointestinal barrier, but Listeria is also able to cross the other two, the blood-brain barrier, as well as the fetal-placental barrier. And if it crosses the blood-brain barrier, then we start seeing central nervous system-related clinical manifestations that can lead to meningitis, long-term sequelae. And, of course, for crossing the fetal-placental barrier, it's not surprising that we see spontaneous abortions, or if the baby can be brought to term, sometimes there are neurological or long-term sequelae that can arise. One of the challenges, of course, with pregnant women is that sometimes it's not easy to spot or to diagnose that listeriosis is an issue because of some of the hormonal changes that take place in pregnancy. So when a mommy sometimes doesn't feel well, sometimes it can be attributed to morning sickness, and until a diagnosis is made, it can be quite a challenge to be able to say if that person is actually suffering from listeriosis or not. So Listeria is quite unique in that sense that it can cause cross the three protective barriers and cause a wide range of disease as a result. Slide number 13 is a schematic that shows why Listeria is even more tricky in terms of some of its control. So what's depicted here on the top left is that Listeria, in this case, or in this figure here, gets engulfed by a macrophage. However, Listeria is able to get inside non-phagocytic cells through a different type of mechanism. But once it becomes engulfed, it actually is able to get out of the phagolysosome, which is kind of a protective encasement that a macrophage or a cell would use to be able to get rid of and destroy invading pathogens. But Listeria is very smart and is able to get out of this kind of jail or detention center, and then is able to proliferate inside the cell. Near the middle of the picture, you can see some little sticks or protrusions coming out of one end. Listeria actually hijacks the host machinery to recruit actin to be able to assemble at one of its ends and therefore get locomotion intracellularly. And it also allows itself to be spread from one cell to another. And by passing from one cell to another, Listeria is actually able to remain intracellularly, and it is not exposed to the outside, which is why there are no vaccines against Listeria, because it's very difficult to get that type of immunity to this microorganism. In the red boxes around the figure are just highlights of some of the major virulence genes that are required for these processes to occur. And they are all under the master control switch, which is a positive regulatory factor A, or PRFA, which is shown on the bottom right there. This master switch gets turned on at 37 degrees, which is quite convenient when Listeria enters inside our bodies, and these virulence factors then are turned on, which allow Listeria to begin its intracellular life cycle. On the next slide, which is slide number 14, now we're going to try to get more into the controlling Listeria in the food manufacturing environment. We're able to find the top 10 food handling practices that contribute to outbreaks that are related to food service establishments, so basically away from the home. And the number one reason listed there is improper cooling. And again, if you remember earlier, we said that Listeria is a psychotrophic organism, meaning they can survive or even grow in the environment. And if temperature is abused in any way, we are now opening a window for this organism to grow to certain numbers that can more easily cause infection once it gets ingested. And there are other, you can see the remaining top 10, so proper cooling, advanced preparation, and an infected person account for the majority of what we see outside the home in terms of factors that contribute to listeriosis outbreaks. Again, advanced preparation usually is tied into a temperature control that becomes faulty. On slide 15, I was able to find the top 10 factors, this time relating to United States, that contribute to foodborne illnesses as a result of ingestion of listeriosis. The temperature percentages, of course, may not be identical to those seen in other countries or, you know, from participants that are on this call now, but the trends can be useful in identifying the most important controls. Temperature control seems to be a universal theme, and in this list, five factors are actually related to temperature or lack thereof during either holding, cooking, or cooling of the food commodity in question. Personal hygiene and health are also another important consideration. And I guess related to personal hygiene in this case would be when we talk about noroviruses and viruses, they're always associated with a lapse in personal hygiene. And this can also be applied to listeria and the development of listeriosis. Hygiene and contamination is also a common theme. Inadequately cleaned equipment seems to be involved in almost one-fourth of all outbreaks that are noted. Cross-contamination from raw animal products associated with 12% of outbreaks, this kind of demonstrates the utility of approved antimicrobial treatments for pathogen reduction on raw animal products. Okay, and it doesn't necessarily have to be an antibiotic per se, but cross-contamination is an important factor that we need to keep into account. On slide 16, I tried to capture some of the things that help us to become exposed to listeria during consumption of food. So the first one there talks about the amounts and the frequency of consumption of a food. When people think about listeriosis, one of the things that they ask is what is the minimum infectious dose. And a lot of people would believe that about 100 cells is enough to make a susceptible individual sick. And obviously, depending on your immune status, less may be able to make you sick. So 100 to 1,000 is the usual kind of levels that are cited. So that addresses the first two points in terms of amount and frequency of the food consumed, as well as in point number two there, the frequency and the levels of listeria in the actual ready-to-eat food that is being consumed. Related to the food commodity is the ability or the potential of the organism to grow during refrigerated storage. And of course, we know how important refrigeration is in terms of controlling listeria, and people are always surprised when we give out thermometers and ask them to place it in the refrigerator, even though they're supposed to be at 4 degrees Celsius or less. Oftentimes, they get closer to 8 or 9 degrees or above, which can be problematic. So that has to do with the refrigerated storage temperature, the duration of the refrigerated storage temperature prior to consumption, so the shelf life of the product. And all of these, I guess, are always related to, directly or not, the actual immune status of the individual. So how strong is our immune system? Do we have other predisposing or underlying factors that can make us more susceptible to listeriosis? On slide 17, I tried to capture a little bit about how listeria gets into the foods, and depending on the surveillance that people do, the environment seems to contribute between, let's say, 1 and 7% of the of how listeria gets into the food. Ruminant farms account for 6% up to 35%. Raw foods entering a food manufacturing facility also contribute to listeria getting in. The food processing environment itself can be negligible up to a major contributor. Again, it depends on the literature and where the studies were done. The ready-to-eat food itself, depending again on the type of food, the survey that was done, and where across the world it was done can contribute insignificantly or up to about 5% of how Listeria gets into our foods. So just to give you a little bit of an idea of how things work there. On slide 18, we start thinking now about if I want to control Listeria, what are some of the things that I should be thinking about if I'm going to get into this business? So one thing there to remember is that the microorganism is found in the environment, which includes food processing, distribution, retail environments, as well as in the home. So we really have to be vigilant at in all levels. Now, because of the ubiquity of Listeria, it can easily enter processing plants or manufacturing environments via raw foods, humans, equipment, shoes, vehicles, etc. And the key point there listed below is once Listeria gets inside a food processing environment, it can establish itself and persist for long periods of time, and regaining control of a plant is sometimes more difficult than maintaining the control and Listeria from getting inside in the first place. All the while, we have to remember that Listeria is a psychotroph and can grow at refrigerated temperatures. In slide number 19, I actually give some concrete examples of how Listeria can persist in a food manufacturing environment once it does get in. And so for those of you who may be familiar with Listeria and have followed it, a lot of these will be familiar to you, and I guess the only one to maybe mention or to discuss is the last one, the cooked poultry, where for 12 years, the same strain of Listeria persisted in the food manufacturing environment. And here we're talking where Listeria was found in the environment, perhaps in the actual final product. The facility was closed down, disinfected, sanitized properly, was allowed to reopen, environment and the food tests negative for a while and then eventually starts testing positive. And this process gets repeated, and in one case, for one factory, 12 years of this type of problem showed that it was the same strain of Listeria, and even recently our colleagues sequenced the genomes of the strain, the original strain, and the same pulse field gel electrophoresis strain that we saw 12 years later, and it turns out that there were not that many differences at the genome level. So Listeria is quite the hardy organism. And once it does get inside, we have to be really careful in how we go about controlling it. We move to slide 20. When we look at investigations into these types of events where there is persistence, one of the things that strikes us is that there's more than one strain of Listeria that can actually exist in a food processing environment. And oftentimes what tends to happen is that there's a lot of focus on the major strain responsible for an outbreak, and oftentimes a different strain that may also be implicated tends to get overlooked. The strain can persist for months or years. Again, once they get inside, they don't seem to want to leave, and there has to be an augmented effort to get rid of them and bring your levels down to zero once you have a problem. And the last point there is just to say that sometimes it's not extremely obvious how Listeria can cause a problem. Again, we always think about deli meats, soft cheeses, etc., but in terms of a food manufacturing facility, if there's too much dust, if there's construction on part of the environment, all of these can contribute to Listeria getting inside, and sometimes that is not often looked at. And the example that I give there is butter, where there was an outbreak related to butter in Finland that occurred a few years ago, and it kind of caught the Listeria community a little bit off guard because butter would not have been one of these vehicles that would have been obvious or that would have made the association with it causing the outbreak. So on slide 21 now, we're getting a little bit more into the food manufacturing environment. And so when we talk about the W5 or who, what, when, where, and why, the first question is, okay, where do we start testing? So the two major divisions there usually include contact surfaces, or do we start testing non-contact surfaces? And I guess in this context, for me, I define a food contact surface as any surface of equipment, utensil, container, or wrapping that actually comes into direct contact with the food commodity itself. Okay, on the next slide, just to further refine kind of my how I tend to see things, I believe that the when you consider the environment of the food manufacturing facility, the equipment that is used to make the food commodity, or the people that operate or actually physically handle the food, the greatest risk seems to be tied to the lethality step. And what happens just before or during the packaging after this lethality step is perhaps where the greatest risk of getting listeria in the final product, because listeria often is a post-processing contamination issue. So it can be a huge problem there. The lethality step itself, of course, has to be a no-failure lethality step, and oftentimes when there's a breach in the lethality step, the listeria is actually able to survive the processing itself. So on the next couple of slides, we have some examples of some of the common non-food contact and food contact surfaces that tend to be sampled or thought about when developing proper GMPs, good manufacturing practices, or HACCP plans, hazard analysis critical control point systems. So on slide 23, we see some kind of major non-food contact surfaces, which would include drains, standing water, any cracks that are in the floor and the walls, tires, high pressure hoses, cleaning equipment, and you know, trash cans, some of the garbage cans, etc. Again, these lists are not exhaustive, but they're just to give you an idea. On on slide number 24, we have some more examples of non-food contact surfaces. The first one, the underside of a conveyor belt, the hollow rollers, you know, roller guards, bearings. These may actually be transporting the actual food or the cooked commodity, but because they are not in direct contact, oftentimes they may get overlooked and they are not sampled as often or as vigorously as perhaps they should. And you can see ice makers, overhead pipes, drip pans, all maintenance tools, any dust, anything that can contribute, but that people don't really think of as coming into contact with the final product, are considered non-food contact surfaces. And on slide number 25, we list major food contact surfaces. So these are the surfaces that actually come into contact with the food commodity. And on the fifth point there, the slicers, dicers, anything that shreds or cuts the cooked product are considered major food contact surfaces. And in fact, during our 2008 deli meat outbreak, the slicer was considered to be a major player in terms of how listeria managed to survive and get itself distributed to the final product. So on slide number 26, now that we have an idea of where we might want to think about sampling, I guess the question then is, when do we actually sample? So these are the kind of the three things that I'd like to think about when this topic comes up. So should we be sampling before the start of a food production, so before the morning shift, for example? Should we be doing environmental sampling then? Should we be doing it during the production of the food commodity itself, so a mid-lot testing, so halfway through the production cycle we would stop and go in and sample for the presence of listeria, or do we do it at the end of the production line in terms of testing the final product itself? And the point that I put at the bottom is one of the things we have to do is to keep in mind, very much like a forensic detective, that if listeria is there, we should try to find it at all costs rather than shying away. One of the things that perhaps historically was seen is that companies sometimes do not want to know if listeria is there. And I think the paradigm shift that has to occur is that if a pathogen is present, we have to find it to the point where the industry must almost be rewarded for finding it, because it means they are being active about it and that something can actually be done to get control of how Listeria actually got there in the beginning. On slide number 27, list a few things that we try to think about. A big issue and often a source of, or maybe a topic of controversy in food microbiology, revolves around testing the environment versus testing the food itself. After all, the food is what is actually being consumed, and if the packaged product, the final product, tests negative, then everything should be okay, and why do we actually have to test the environment? A key point related to that, of course, is that proper statistics in terms of sampling has to be applied to end product testing. Otherwise, there is no meaningful data that can be gained from some end product testing. So environmental sampling seems to be the way to go. It's more sensitive for assessing control than end product testing would be. If you test your end product and it tests positive, then you've confirmed you have a problem, but it doesn't tell you where the problem occurred or what you can do to address that situation or that problem. Environmental sampling, on the other hand, can give you these useful clues to help address where Listeria is entering and how we can avoid it from getting into the end product. Testing for Listeria species, because now there's also the question of, do we look for indicator organism or do we look for the pathogen itself? Within the genus, the family of Listeria, there are some that are not human pathogens, and a lot of people think that we should be looking for that organism because it still is a Listeria, versus looking for the pathogen itself. And I put under the last point, academia versus industry, and I've always thought about, like, from an academic perspective, if any Listeria is present in a food manufacturing environment, for me that raises a flag that something is wrong and that we should be thinking about getting that under control. And there are different camps out there that may think, well, as long as the pathogen is not present, it's not as much of a deal that the non-pathogenic Listeria is present, because sometimes it can be more common in food manufacturing environments. I tend to be the former, where any Listeria present in a food manufacturing environment is a cause for concern and should raise a flag. If we move to slide number 28, here we are talking about now the who of the W5. So here, these are just probably very common sense issues, but at the same time, they can affect a lot of things. So for example, knowledge of aseptic techniques, a strong microbiology background, and you know, issues related to proper sampling and microbiology is very important, because oftentimes what we tend to see is some people are trained for weeks or months, and then they believe they are able to go out and do the proper work, and sometimes that can be misleading as well. Experience in environmental sampling is key and crucial. If I have never been inside a food manufacturing facility, I could be the smartest microbiologist, but I may not know where I should be sampling. And so if I go into a food manufacturing facility and tell them they have to test 10,000 samples a month, but I don't pick the right 10,000 places they should be swabbing and sampling, then it becomes problematic. Individuals that are experienced and familiar with plant equipment and manufacturing facilities, as well as the flow and how things enter and exit, including people, into a factory, can be very important as well. If we go to slide 29, now we start looking at exactly what it is. So I mentioned a bit before about, should we be testing for indicator organisms such as the non-pathogenic Listeria, or perhaps a different organism that may give us an indication that Listeria may be there? Should we be testing for the pathogen itself? And the considerations there are given at the bottom, that include, you know, indicators can be better and safer, especially if testing is done on site. Indicators tend to occur more frequently than the pathogen, so if you're able to control the indicator, you have a higher degree of confidence you're controlling the pathogen. And a faster turnaround time for the actual indicator test can be an attractive feature versus pathogen-specific assays, which can take days to sometimes to weeks to be able to get a result. On slide 30, we're talking here about, again, it's probably obvious, and sometimes it's not, but, you know, when we talk about testing or monitoring for Listeria, it's always good for industry to comply with regulations. Certainly a recall or, you know, heaven forbid, an outbreak where there's morbidity and mortality, it can ruin business and the bad press therefore lingers. Sometimes it's consumer-driven, and so these are kind of the perhaps not as important ones, but the last two are really key. One is to have a warning system in place to reduce and help avoid problems of Listeria, and also to help verify that your HACCP or SOPs, standard operating procedures for production of whatever food it is you're doing, actually work. And that's why it's key to test for Listeria. In the next slide, 31, is just to discuss the importance or maybe the role of end product testing. I think the field now is going towards testing of the environment to get a better idea of where Listeria is and how to control it, but sometimes end product testing can be useful, and here we're looking at the why. So we did find Listeria on a contact surface or sometimes a non-food contact surface. It helps us to comply with the regulations in terms of the minimum amount of testing that has to be done, and it also helps to verify the monitoring program that is present. The thing to remember in terms of end product testing is that Listeria is not uniformly spread. The lot ideally should be held until negative results for representative samples being tested. Again, there the key is statistical sampling has to be sound. You have to test enough end product to be able to say that your results represent the whole of the lot, keeping in mind that Listeria is not uniformly spread unless perhaps we're talking about a liquid type of food. And the last point there is, and it's very important again, is there a corrective action plan in place should the product be positive for Listeria, rather than just saying, okay, our product is positive, we're going to do a recall, and then, you know, start again from the beginning. On page 32, I list some of the things that we actually knew quite a while ago about some of these food and food manufacturing facilities. One is that some plant layouts were unacceptable, including some of the older manufacturing buildings that were built. Oftentimes, the facilities are built with engineers that are not perhaps appreciative of some of the food microbiology issues that we encounter in our own day-to-day activities. The other thing is that Listeria will continue to enter a plant environment, so just because you don't have a problem doesn't mean that it may not become one for your particular processing facility. Listeria, if it's present on the floor, again, so a non-food contact surface, has been shown to increase the risk of getting a positive packaging line and therefore increasing the risk of getting a positive end product. The harborage sites in the equipment themselves is also important. Air, people, packaging materials seem to be rarely sources of Listeria, but in some cases they can be. And what is often seen where with bigger manufacturing facilities where different lines are responsible for developing or producing different commodities, contamination seems to be limited to only one of these lines. If we continue on slide number 33, another thing that tends to come out and that people have known for a while now is that rinsing equipment during production is detrimental to any type of Listeria control that you are trying to get. It's much easier to maintain control than to regain it, especially when we think about one of the earlier slides where Listeria has a great preponderance to persist in the environment. The mentality has to be to continually strive for zero positives, meaning that you never get an environmental monitoring or an environmental sample testing positive for Listeria. We also have to have the thinking that Listeria can be controlled in ready-to-eat facilities and operations, and we have to have proper plans in place when we do find a positive. But we have to go in with the thinking that we don't have listeria and that we are able to control it. On slide 34, we start addressing now what happens when we start finding some of these tests to be positive, whether it's in the environment or the food commodity itself. One of the things we have to think about is, okay, we find listeria in the food manufacturing environment. Is it a transient or is it a resident problem? Resident problems are obviously more difficult and more challenging to address. Listeria could be a transient. It just came in for whatever reason, and it's easily controlled by cleaning and sanitizing. And what happens in those situations is that limited amounts of foods are exposed. If it's a resident issue, it can be contaminated or becomes established in one or more sites throughout the environment, and therefore it becomes more problematic because it could persist over a long time and its chances get increased to affect a number of lots as well as a number of lines within the factory environment. On slide number 35, we showed two major conditions that cause problems, and those are biofilm production, and the second one is harborage sites, or these niches that Listeria likes to call home. On slide 36, with just a few words about biofilms. As we know, biofilms occur when microorganisms become embedded in a matrix of organic polymers that are produced by the cells. And in fact, a lot of the microorganisms that are studied are usually in some sort of association. And these offer perfect protection to sanitizing agents. Biofilms provide favorable conditions for growth and survival, and they're a lot harder to get rid of. Continuing on slide 37, they are obviously an important concern if biofilms get formed after this lethality step or after the food commodity is cooked. The processing environment, especially if it's a food contact surface, will appear clean and acceptable even after sanitization. And so it's kind of hard to see if a biofilm is in place oftentimes. Microbial sampling of a biofilm can also be problematic. We have to be able to, for example, if we are sampling or swabbing, you have to swab fairly rigorously to be able to dislodge a biofilm if it's there and to be able to actually detect it. And the last point there is LM, which is Listeria monocytogenes, can attach and form biofilms on a variety of surfaces that include stainless steel, polymers, rubber gaskets, etc. On slide 38, in addition to the biofilms, we have some examples of some of the niches that Listeria likes to make itself and create a home for itself. Inside the hollow rollers for the conveyor belts, and these are obviously close to the actual food that is being made, sometimes surprisingly, but hydraulic oils and bearing greases can be a home for these organisms. Inside hollow supports for equipment and between two layers of material. And I just showed an example from the VTT Technical Research Center of Finland, where non-food grade lubricants seem to have some sort of antimicrobial effect on Listeria, but because we can't use those in a food manufacturing facility, we are forced to use food grade lubricants, and often those are not inhibitory to the organism itself. So these can be problematic. On slide 39, we have, I tried to pose the question, how do we go about sampling? For the most part, when it comes to sampling of the environment, it's done with a swab or some sort of sponge. With the rest of the points that I've listed there include other sampling materials that could be useful for testing depending on the food that is being manufactured. So sometimes mops, residues on filters, product finds, or sweepings from the floor might not be considered appropriate sampling material, but sometimes they can be extremely useful. And we'll get back to the issue of swabs and sponges in a little bit. On slide 40, just to introduce the concept of zone testing, the zone concept has been put forth now for a few years as a useful tool in gauging how serious it can be to find a positive environmental test result. So as we go from zone 4, which would be the furthest away from the actual end product, to zone 1, which includes the food, the product contact surfaces, it becomes more important that Listeria not be found. So the closer we go from zone 4 to zone 1, we have to make sure that Listeria is not found in the commodity or in the environment at all. On slide 41, we address here again the different approaches that I have seen or that people discuss when they monitor the production facility. One obviously is to sample the product as it is being processed. The other is sampling the environment. So again, end product testing versus environmental testing. And I guess my addition to this debate or discussion is shown at the bottom. The time from the final processed food to cleaning to sampling, I think, is extremely important and something that I think a lot of people don't think about. So, for example, if a certain lot is finished, the cleaning crew comes in and sanitizes and disinfects all the equipment. Well, how long after the sanitizing that has been done is the sample actually taken, and does that affect the ability to actually detect or isolate or monitor the presence of Listeria monocytogenes in that environment? So slide 42 just shows us, do we get a question, can we get some control of Listeria? Obviously the answer is yes. On slide number 43, we list the two major strategies for control. So eliminating biofilms or any niches or environments that can lead to unacceptable microbial, and of course this doesn't apply to just Listeria now, has to be a central focus. And importantly, too, is using a sampling program that can assess in a timely manner whether the environment is under control or not. Again, I think the industry has to be encouraged to find a problem if it exists, because then we are able to do something about it and bring things back under control. So it's a very much a multi-pronged approach that involves a variety of strategies. Some of these are discussed in the next slide. On slide 44, some of these strategies here include prevention of the establishment and growth in niches that can lead to contamination, especially if biofilm formation can be allowed to occur. We want to prevent that. Implementation of a sampling plan and a proper and effective sampling plan. It's not just sufficient to go in and sample randomly. You have to sample intelligently and at the right locations and at the right time. It's important to have rapid and effective responses to any of the positives, especially the environmental samplings that were done. And the bottom three, I think, are key in terms of getting control over your manufacturing. What kind of verification or follow-up plan do you have? Is there problems and trends? In other words, is there a short-term assessment? Okay, there's a problem, your end product ends up getting positive, we address that, and once you disinfect your facility and the environmental samples are negative and your end product is negative, then you're able to reopen for business. But is there any follow-up that is done to say, well, what actually did happen, and what can we learn and what can we put in place so that it doesn't happen in the future? And that ties in with the last bullet there about long-term assessment. Do we go back and say, well, we've had certain problems over the last few years, let's try to take a broad look to see, versus we've never had a problem, suddenly we do, what could we be doing different? These types of things. A lot of people don't think of doing long-term assessments of their manufacturing facilities. On slide 45, we try to bring in the biology. There's a lot of people that study Listeria, and of course one of the many challenges for regulatory authorities lies in developing sound policies, guidelines, documents, and strategies that are science-based. This slide illustrates the parameters that are described in the literature that are shown in the table above that gives us an idea of the types of temperatures, the pH, the salt, the water activity, and the salt that affect or not Listeria, and a lot of this is based on research that has been done. What's listed near the bottom is how a lot of governments and regulatory and food manufacturing companies and agencies try to use the information from the literature that and the science to develop general guidelines. And so, for example, if the pH is 5 to 5.5 and the water activity is less than 0.95, the food is considered safe from a Listeria perspective because Listeria cannot grow. Similarly, if the pH is less than 5, then it doesn't matter what the water activity might be, and if the water activity, the last point, is less than 0.92, then the pH can be any value and Listeria would not be a serious issue. And the point at the bottom is that everything is commodity dependent, of course, and that's one of the things that people have to keep in mind when they are developing a food product. On slide 46 is just to show an example of how things can complicate life, of course. So we have, from the previous slide, things that we know from research and then how we use them to try to develop guidelines. Well, when I first started working in Listeria as an undergrad student, one of the things that we were able to show, and in fact we were one of the first groups to show, the effect of acid shock on heat resistance. So if Listeria is exposed, for example, during marination of foods, even if this marination occurs in the refrigerator, it could allow Listeria to become more resistant to the heat or the lethality step that takes place later on down the road. And so when we think about the pH of 5 to 5.5, we have to keep in mind that how long is that food kept at that pH, and can it have an effect down the road in terms of being able to control Listeria, even if it is with a cooking step, which normally would get rid of the organism. On slide 47, we have what is, in my mind, controlling Listeria. So I have it broken down into three points, and in the next few slides also illustrates a little bit my own simplistic view. So obviously having in place proper steps or procedures to destroy Listeria, anything that's listeriocidal is obviously preferred. Being able to identify the source of contamination, and having in place procedures that will help eliminate or reduce these contamination sources. Oftentimes, because of how the equipment is made or the building is constructed, the contamination sources or the niches may not be easily controlled, but if we know where they are, sometimes we can intervene. On slide 48, I have my own kind of personal thoughts on a few things. On the left side there, cleaning, some of the things that I usually tell people to think about is if you use high-pressure hoses to clean your drains or your floor, you actually may be helping some of these biofilms to become dislodged, and you're creating aerosols, and you may actually be helping to distribute Listeria throughout your environment. Same thing if when they're using compressed air for cleaning or drying the equipment, we have to be wary that we're not dislodging any biofilm. Wet mid-shift cleaning can also be problematic. It's been shown to be detrimental to controlling Listeria, and in fact can exacerbate or make it worse, as is stacking of any equipment or machinery. On the right side, with respect to cleaning tools, sometimes these are things that are not really thought about because they're considered cleaning equipment, and it's often assumed that cleaning and disinfecting products work all the time. And that is only true when they are used in the appropriate directions that they're supposed to be used. So mixing and matching tools, daily sanitization of tools, does that actually occur? Where are they stored? And sometimes these cloths and sponges, are they reusable? You know, they're used once to clean and then they're disinfected and then they're used again. Is that a better issue? At the bottom of that slide, I list some things that I don't believe many people are actually thinking about. So, okay, I found Listeria in the food manufacturing environment. Now what? Should I be rotating the sanitizer because I found Listeria? Does that mean that the sanitizer I used was effective, but now Listeria has figured out a way to become resistant? The sanitizer biology, is that being respected in terms of contact time, the actual concentration of the active ingredient, the temperature it should be applied to, the amount of time, etc.? And the last point there is about a Listeria hotspot. If Listeria tends to become more frequent at a certain location in the environment, what should we do? And in fact, while we should be encouraging industry for finding Listeria positives in the environment because it allows us to identify and to help control an issue, what is the normal finding? Is it normal to find Listeria once or twice a month, even if it never makes it into the final product? Is it in, even though we're striving for zero positives, I'm not quite sure that industry in general, or even in the Listeria world, what the consensus is for normal findings. And that is something that is under discussion as well. On slide 49 is something, again, when I first got into this business of Listeria, sometimes the obvious is perhaps the least obvious and sometimes the more important. I had a discussion with my supervisor, Jeff Farber, at the time, and I thought I asked a dumb question. I said, well, has anybody ever looked at these sponges or swabs that are used to sample the environment? You know, is it possible that they may somehow inhibit the growth of Listeria themselves? And we were surprised, and we published it in 1995, where at that time, commercially available sponges and swabs used for swabbing the environment actually did have inhibitory effects against Listeria species, therefore making it even harder for somebody to be able to detect Listeria if it was there. On slide 50, we have reducing the risks of Listeriosis. Again, common approaches, avoid cross-contamination. And in this point here, not as much from the typical cross-contamination that people think about in terms of working with raw chicken and then not washing your hands and then working with lettuce or something that, you know, that is ready to eat, but more so in terms of sanitization. When you disinfect and clean your equipment or your facility, care has to be put so that you don't actually spread Listeria in your aim of trying to control it. And the other points there, incorporating ingredients that may inhibit the growth of Listeria, can be something that is useful in reducing the risk of Listeria, especially in a day where consumers now want less salt, they want less chemicals in our foods, and by removing these, we now remove the traditional hurdles that used to be in place to control Listeria. So if we go to slide 51, what we have there is something that is starting to be seen now, and it's called trend analysis, which is not something new in the field, but can be a useful tool for the food processing environment. When we evaluate microbial controls, it's important to control process variability. And these examples here, these four graphs, illustrate different trends. So if we start from the left top, the first example, the process seems to be under control except for one of these production lots, which is above the horizontal line, and that is the line that represents our control limit where we assume that we have Listeria under control. So in the first one, we have everything is under control except one lot. It's a fairly uniform process, minimum variation. It would be suitable there to further evaluate that specific lot to see what happened and where things went wrong. In the second example, we have on the top right is a upward trend where initially Listeria seems to be controlled, but we have to try to determine the cause of this upward trend in order to restore control as soon as possible. And if we don't do long-term assessments and using trend analysis, these things become a burden. The third example at the bottom left shows significant variations in the levels, many of which approach the level of unacceptability. It would be worthwhile here to study the process or processes perhaps that determine this cause of variation and then to reduce them, obviously, to have better assurance that food safety is maintained, especially when a lot of the testing is very, very close to that horizontal line that we consider to be the control limit. And then the last example shows a significant, I guess, shift in the microbial numbers with very little initial variation. So something has occurred and it seems to be a constant source of contamination. This situation obviously needs to be investigated because we want to get control as soon as possible because something is chronically wrong. On slide 52, I guess, is just if I was in a live audience, I would use this cartoon to try to generate some laughter and saying, I suppose there is a way to make sure food is safe at all costs, but you know, it would lead me into an immunological discussion in terms of eating sterile food and what that can do or cannot do for the human body. So I think we need to be a little familiar with that aspect as well. On slide 53 shows a report and a web link the report that was that came out as a result of the Delhi outbreak that occurred in Canada in 2008 due to the contaminated maple leaf product. The final part of this presentation then will look at some aspects of this outbreak, and more information can be found in this report here. So I'm including the link because I may not have time to discuss all aspects. One of the things on slide 54, one of the initiatives that came out is changing the Health Canada policy for ready-to-eat foods. And this shows basically that we basically updated operational and sampling guidelines to be able to enhance the ability to detect listeria if it is there. And we also, of course, work with other countries, and we wanted to be in compliance criteria with Codex Alimentarius. On slide 55 is an example of the table that we produced to show the proposed criteria. So we have three, category 1, and then category 2A and 2B. And this policy that was put forth was developed in line, to be in line with the International Codex Alimentarius standards. It was posted on the Government of Canada's website, and in fact received feedback from all walks of life, which included industry, academia, hospitals, lay people, basically anybody who had opinions or comments about the new policy was able to comment to help us refine and maybe think about other aspects that we might have not thought about in the first place. So that gives you an idea of the types of criteria that has been put forth. On slide 56, again, it's just to highlight the fact that the consumer has an important role to play in food safety. Too often it's assumed that if we go to the grocery store, then all the food must be safe that's there because it was made, you know, by a reputable company in an acceptable and responsible manner. And oftentimes that is. But the example that we think about is if you are running a whole bunch of errands in a single outing and you leave your food in the trunk of a car in the middle of the summer, you may be providing unfavorable conditions, especially in terms of temperature abuse, which would allow some pathogens, including listeria, to grow. So I think the important message from this cartoon is that the consumer cannot simply wash his or her hands from the concept of food safety. On slide 57, this slide, I guess, is a reminder that while I didn't discuss it in this presentation in any detail, methodology in terms of being able to detect or isolate listeria is a huge component in monitoring, tracking this organism's behavior. And that's a whole new, perhaps it can make the topic of another teleclass in terms of how we go about detecting listeria and what's the best way to go about doing that. So on slide 58 is basically a small introduction to some of the highlights of this famous outbreak that we had in the summer of 2008. On slide 59, it's just to recap a little bit of what was said earlier. While the incidence of listeriosis is very low compared to other foodborne pathogens, its high case fatality rate of 20 to 30% is quite notable. And the point of this slide is to indicate that this deli meat outbreak was in fact the first meat-related outbreak that Canada had ever seen before, and it was kind of surprising, I suppose, and also caught us not as much unaware, but it was a new vehicle that was identified that never seemed to be an issue before in Canada. On slide 60, I list here some of the common serotypes that are seen in Canada. And again, unlike some of the other countries or maybe some of the other outbreaks where the serotype 4B seems to be the most dominant and oftentimes considered the most virulent or pathogenic of the listeria serotypes, Canada, we somehow seem to be hospitable to the 1, 2A, serotypes, which account for almost 50% of the serotypes that are isolated. And just a note, at the bottom right of the table, I just noticed now that it should not be a tick, but it should actually have 100 to total that column. So I apologize for that. So on slide 61, I guess it's an example of what we see inside a food manufacturing facility. And in the next couple of slides, I just want to highlight some of the things that we saw with the listeriosis outbreak. So on slide 62, just a reminder, I guess, to our foreign listeners that Canada has, you know, 10 provinces and territories. They're grouped into regions. We have about 34 million inhabitants as of 2010. And so in 2008, we had this national outbreak, which resulted in 57 confirmed cases in seven of these 10 provinces, with a total of 23 deaths. And of course, it made major headlines in every newspaper in the country, and I would assume also outside the country. On slide 63 is some of the highlights. Basically, what happened was there were 3 weeks of higher than expected case reports of listeriosis in Ontario, the province of Ontario, which, you know, caused eyebrows to be raised. Investigations were done. On August the 6th, the Toronto Public Health Unit informed the Canadian Food Inspection Agency of two listeriosis cases that occurred at a single Toronto nursing home. That was one of the key events there as well. Following the investigation that was led by the Canadian Food Inspection Agency, the source of the listeria was eventually linked to one of the establishments, 97B, which was Maple Leaf Foods Canada, which was producing a ready-to-eat meat product. And eventually that product was seen and caused problems in seven provinces during the outbreak. Slide 64 gives us an idea of the case exposures to the ready-to-eat meat products. The public health inspectors were able to verify product information for 27 of the 50 cases who consumed the deli meat. Again, because of the incubation period, sometimes it can be quite the challenge. But through interviews with administrators and records that were reviewed at hospitals and homes for the aged, public health inspectors were able to verify that the institutions where these 27 cases were noted, they actually consumed the deli meat from this establishment, 97B, although that establishment, or Maple Leaf in general, may not have been the sole supplier of processed meat products. Of the 23 cases who reported eating deli meat, 9 cases reported or remembered eating Maple Leaf brand products, but it was not verified if these were actually from that specific establishment, that's to say 97B. And no brand information was available for 13 of the cases who had reported eating deli meat, or one case that reported eating other, i.e. not Maple Leaf brand dairy meat. In terms of geographic distribution, which is shown on slide 55, again, we have a little map of Canada on the right, and on the left we can see the provinces where this product was consumed and caused cases or deaths. And we also note there that in two of the cases in Ontario, they were probable but not 100% confirmed, because the pulse field of gel electrophoresis, or the molecular typing pattern, was not available for those two cases. And the majority of the food made from that establishment was in Ontario, or was sent to Ontario, which is why Ontario has the disproportionate burden of the confirmed cases as well as the death. In terms of descriptive epidemiology, on slide 66, we can see how the numbers broke down. The mean age was 75. The age range was 29 to 98, 67% female. Again, 100% of those affected were immunocompromised in one way, shape, or form. And 84% was institutional exposure, where most of the product that was made from that establishment ended up going to. On slide 67, we see some of the major public health actions that came about. So on August 17, there was a recall. Canadian Food Inspection Agency and Maple Leaf Foods warned the public not to serve or consume a sure slice roast beef and corned beef product because they may have been contaminated with Listeria. On August 19, the CFIA and Maple Leaf Foods now warned the public not to consume any ready-to-eat deli meat products from Facility 97B and showed the people how to go about identifying what Establishment 97B was on a ready-to-eat food commodity. On August 24, Maple Leaf Foods voluntarily recalled all products manufactured at that facility in Toronto. And on the 24th as well, that facility was later on that day was actually shut down and a complete disinfection of the entire plant was commenced, even though not all the product or all the lines of 97B were in fact positive. Slide 68 shows a little bit of the information about the environmental work that was done. 97B had several production lines that produced a variety of ready-to-eat meat products, including the Sure Slice that was distributed nationally across Canada. None of the product left the country. The Sure Slice brand itself included six different types of deli meats, primarily marketed to hotels, restaurants, and institutions, which included homes and homes for the aged and hospitals, where, again, to remind ourselves that is where we find people that have immunological deficiencies. On page 69, the strain that actually caused the outbreak was not a single strain. As I mentioned, Listeria likes to travel in groups. There were three distinct but highly related strains that may have been involved in the outbreak, and we'll discuss why. Two isolates that were found to harbor a 50 kilobase pair mobile genetic island encoding translocation and efflux functions that have not been observed in other Listeria genomes. And those have been and are being tested now for possible role in terms of maintaining or establishing itself in that facility, as well as perhaps lending itself to being resistant to perhaps disinfections or sanitizers. On slide 70, we have a bit of detailed information about the reference outbreak strains for those of you who are listening who are interested or more into Listeria from an academic perspective. It was a serotype 1-2A. The pulse field type is listed there, which is the PulseNet Canada designations that are given to it. The ribotype was 1045. It belonged to the lineage 2. It had a clonal complex of 8. The sequence type, or ST, was 120, and it's related to the epidemic clone 3. So again, it wasn't one of these typical 4B serotypes that are commonly thought about in terms of causing major outbreaks. On slide 71, we actually see two pulse field gel electrophoresis patterns of two of these three possible outbreak strains. As you can see on the top part, there is a difference based on one band shift, the 476 versus the 444 KB. Our Listeriosis Reference Service, and as well as laboratories at the Canadian Food Inspection Agency, rarely saw the Listeria strain shown in lane B from actual foods. Ourselves here at the Listeria Reference Service, we never actually saw it from a contaminated food, although that isolate shown in lane B was seen in clinical patients. So where or why it wasn't found is kind of an interesting thing as well in the food. On slide 72, we actually show the difference between those band shifts that was discovered through genome sequencing by Dr. Matthew Gilmore at the National Microbiology Laboratory in Winnipeg, who's actually the co-director of the Listeriosis Reference Service along with myself. And basically that difference comes down to the strain having a bacteriophage or a prophage inserted in its genome. And we did some work during the outbreak as well as after, and it should be noted that the outbreak strain does not necessarily or is not necessarily more resistant to sanitizers or disinfectants. So we do not think at the moment that somehow Listeria evolved through selection or other type of mechanism to be able to better survive that actual facility. On slide 73, the expectations that, I guess, come out after an outbreak in terms of the trend analysis scenarios that I described earlier are shown here. So before the outbreak, tracking the number of positive sites in the environment and making sure that everyone was properly doing their job, everything was sanitized, seemed to be kind of the norm, whereas now there's a focus or a push from all industry as well as government and people that are involved in the food business to do daily scientific analysis, to look for repeat patterns. Are there root causes? Is there, you know, sometimes it could be simply a management oversight or it could be something further. So again, going back and looking at and studying why things have occurred can be extremely important. On slide 74, one of the it's another document that resulted as because of the outbreak, it caused us to think a little bit more in terms of how to deal with all these factors in a timely way during an actual investigation. So a weight of evidence document was described, which tells us a little bit about how we treat an open versus a closed sample. So it's not surprising to think that when an establishment cafeteria, just like my own cafeteria, if we open a closed package that just comes in from a factory, we would probably wrap it up after we finished using it in some sort of clear plastic wrap and then put it in our refrigerator. In that context, then that becomes an open sample. And so what is the how much weight should we apply to that now when that food later on tests positive? Is it because it was cross-contaminated, or is it because it's an actual source? And if we don't know where that wrapped food comes from, it can cause further problems. What is the molecular type of the organism, for example? Is it common in the population? Is molecular fingerprinting or characterization of the Listeria in question the same from what is seen normally, or in our case of this Listeria outbreak, the molecular pattern had not been seen before, so it was useful and easy to say that something is wrong. But let's say all the patterns that we saw during the outbreak were very similar or identical to those that caused sporadic cases. It certainly would have caused a lot more problems in terms of being able to address where the outbreak occurred. On slide number 75, I tried to capture a little bit what this weight of evidence decision-making document tries to do. Again, it is a guideline document that involves microbiology, epidemiology, as well as environmental assessment. It's primarily a tool for federal-level decision-makers to help them during foodborne outbreak investigations. It is meant to describe those factors to consider and to provide guidance on how much weight that we can assign to them when looking at microbiological, epidemiological, as well as food safety investigations, and which are the more important factors that help us to identify what the root cause of the outbreak is. On slide 76, what we can see is another positive development as a result of an unfortunate outbreak. So here, the Maple Leaf Foods, in fact, it's the whole of the Canadian industry, have always been active partners with government to help push the greater concept of food safety. So here was just the first page of a document that is currently being reviewed for wide use in the meat industry. And this is, you know, what are the best practices that anybody in the meat industry should be thinking about in terms of effectively controlling Listeria monophytogenes. And in fact, I can say too that other groups or commodities, fruits, vegetables, dairy, fish, etc., are also thinking about coming up with similar types of documents and guidelines that can be useful. I guess slides 77 and 78 are just to include some references or other information that may be of use to some of you in the audience, because again, it's not easy to predict who is listening to the teleclass, so there may be people that are interested in getting more information. At the bottom there is my email. I'm not sure if we'll have time to entertain questions, but you're more than welcome to email me about certain points. I try to make it a a priority to say something controversial, whether it's intentional or not, or to be provocative so that, you know, people can think. And so if anything seems out of the ordinary, it was probably because of that, to generate some sort of discussion. And so again, on page 78, we have a few sites, internet sites that may be useful to some of you who are interested in ready-to-eat foods and Listeria and how we can somehow get control over this organism. And on the last slide, 79, I just list what's coming up in the next few teleclasses. I encourage, of course, everybody knows about the Weber training site. I thank Paul for the invitation, Nicole for hosting this teleclass, and for all of you for taking time from your busy schedule to listen. I hope it's been useful. And at this time, I would pass it back to Nicole.
Great. Thank you so much, Dr. Pakoda, for taking the time and educating us today on listeriosis. And I know there's several points that I'm going to be taking home, and especially around home food safety and the use or storage of leftovers and how I store my leftovers at work. And thank you again to everyone for participating today, and I hope that you'll participate in the Weber training teleclasses that are coming up in the next coming weeks. Thank you very much, and everyone have a wonderful afternoon.